This episode of The Working Songwriter is brought to you by Yamaha Guitars. 2026 marks the 60th anniversary of Yamaha Guitars. That's six decades of innovation, expertise, and instruments that have inspired players like John Denver, Bob Dylan, Elliott Smith, Billy Corgan, and Keith Urban. From legendary FG Red Label guitars to modern innovations like their Transacoustic series, Yamaha continues to set the gold standard for acoustic guitar craftsmanship worldwide. To celebrate 60 years of guitar excellence, visit Yamaha.com and stop by your local Yamaha dealer today.
Hi, and welcome to The Working Songwriter, the show where today's best songwriters come to talk shop. I'm your host, Joe Pug. Each episode here, we host a distinguished guest, and we ask them to go deep on their inspiration, on their process, on the general ups and downs of making a life in music. So, whether you're a grizzled veteran, still ordering 3,000 CDs for a new release because you refuse to admit that the market has crashed, or else a scrappy upstart, ordering 3,000 CDs as an ironic flex. This is your show, because ultimately, it is what every writer seeks most, an ironclad excuse to put off actually writing. Hey everyone, it's the third Friday of May 2026, and I thank you for being here. This week's show is brought to you by Bandzoogle. Built by musicians and for musicians, Bandzoogle is an all-in-one platform to build a beautiful website for your music. I'm old enough to remember when you had to pay somebody called a web developer to get a website made. It'd always be some guy named Samson who drove a Nissan Xterra with a vanity plate that referenced Too Fast, Too Furious, and who was always trying to sell you herbal supplements with the implication that your wife was unsatisfied. And old Samson would charge you about $1,000 for a website that would be obsolete in 6 months. But it's the future now, you guys. That's not how it works anymore. We're allowed to have nice things now. One of those nice things is Bandzoogle. For over 20 years, Bandzoogle has made it easy to build a stunning website and online store for your music. Now they've added a brand new EPK plan so that musicians can create a professional, single-page electronic press kit in minutes. Everything you need is already built in. Music players, images, text bio, video embeds, a gig calendar, press quotes, and access to Bandzoogle's award-winning support team 7 days a week. The new EPK plan starts at just $6.95 per month, and the Working Songwriter podcast listeners can go to Bandzoogle.com to try it for free for 30 days. Then use the promo code TWSEPK to get 10% off the first year of any new EPK plan subscription. Finally, if you enjoyed this podcast, if you'd like to help it remain a viable endeavor for me, here's a couple things that you could do to help. First and foremost, you could become a subscriber to The Vault. What is The Vault? The Vault is a private, members-only section of my website that hosts every single episode of The Working Songwriter ever recorded. Currently, only the latest 100 episodes are available in iTunes and on Spotify for free. Additionally, The Vault has every single album I've ever recorded for streaming and download. Not all of them are on Spotify. There's also an archive of the iconic Enthusiast Digest newsletter there. Go to joepugmusic.com/vault, become a subscriber today. It's about the price of a nice cup of coffee every month. And for your generosity, you'll also receive all of that content. If you're not in a place where you can contribute in that way, I totally understand. You could still help us out in a couple of ways that are free. First, you could leave us a rating in the iTunes store, or second, you could simply tell a friend about the show. Spread the word about the show. The simple math on those two things is that they will help me much more than they will be a pain in the ass for you. Okay, I'll end all the harassment there. I hope that you enjoy this week's episode. Our guest this week hails from Canada and has spent over four decades writing hit songs. Eddie Schwartz got his start as a solo artist, but has found great success writing for and with other artists. His song, Hit Me With Your Best Shot, was recorded by Pat Benatar and became a certified platinum crossover hit. He went on to pen songs for Donna Summer, the Doobie Brothers, the Pointer Sisters, and many others. As a former president of the Songwriters Association of Canada and a Northern American president of the International Council of Music Creators, he's been a tireless advocate for songwriters. He's received multiple BMI, SOCAN, and Juno awards. In 2012, he was awarded the Order of Canada, one of the country's highest civilian honors. I got a chance to catch up with Mr. Schwartz a few months ago to hear about his musical journey so far. Mr. Eddie Schwartz, what an honor to have you on the Working Songwriter podcast. You got your start where you grew up, I believe in Toronto. What did the music scene look like in Toronto in the 60s and early 70s when you were first getting started?
Well, thanks for having me on the show, Joe. I appreciate it. Yeah, it was a very exciting time. Toronto had a million, you know, well, maybe a million is a slight exaggeration, but a lot of great little clubs. I was under drinking age, but they were coffee houses. Yeah. Just go get a cup of coffee and see amazing people. I mean, the people who came through town and were from Canada, the Joni Mitchell, and, you know, I saw James Taylor with about two other people in a small coffee house in Toronto before he made it big time. And just many, a whole long list of people, plus guys like Gordy Lightfoot, who, you know, were already world famous out of Canada. So it was an incredibly exciting scene, kind of like a mini, there was an area in Toronto called Yorkville, which was kind of like a mini Greenwich Village. And so that was an amazing time and place to be. And because I had a cousin in New York who lived in the Greenwich Village, I also got to go down there and hang with her and hear guys like Bob Dylan and the Blues Project and the Young Rascals when they were still just breaking or even unknown. So it was between Toronto, New York, there was a lot going on.
Wow. So if you were seeing Dylan at that time, I was thinking that maybe Ronnie Hawkins and the Hawks with the band playing with them would have been before your time, but was that legacy still knocking around when you were getting your start?
It totally was, but I was too young because they were playing a place called the Colonial on the main drag in Toronto, Yonge Street. And I couldn't drink. So they were playing to the slightly older crowd, but they were legendary already. I mean, you know, Ronnie Hawkins, and they were already well known. But unfortunately, it was a few years later that before I could get into those kind of clubs.
And when you went down to New York City, how old were you? And how was it different than Toronto music-wise?
I was 12, the earliest trip. And my in those days, you could just, you know, if you're, you know, parents let kids do things like at 12, get on a bus going from Toronto to Grand Central Station. My cousin had a cold water, you know, a cold water flat, I guess they called them in Greenwich Village, in the East Village on St. Mark's Place. And I slept on the floor, and she was very cool. My cousin Edith was just tremendous influence on me. She was a huge Dylan fan, you know, early on, and gave me one of his early records and said, check this out. And I listened to it and thought, man, this guy can't sing to save his life. Wow. I don't, what does she see in this guy? But because I looked up to her so much, she was a few years older than I was. I just kept playing it over and over again. And somewhere along the line, maybe five or six times into listening to I think it was Freewheeling, Bob Dylan. It was actually, I went, oh, okay, these songs are absolutely amazing. And then, you know, it's been a huge Dylan fan ever since.
I didn't have that experience with Dylan. I liked it from the first time I heard it. But I will say there are several artists who have become my favorite, almost my favorite top 10 artists. And when I first heard their music, I didn't like it in the way that you just described. And it took kind of like a revealing over time. But then it ended up overtaking everything else that I liked on first blush.
Yeah, it's amazing how that can work. And there are a number of artists. I remember Melanie. I don't know if you know, you remember Melanie, she had a big moment, and it was the same kind of thing. She was, and I really ended up loving the record, but you know, what do you people see in this artist? I mean, I just couldn't, you know, couldn't grasp it. But you know, sometimes you come a little late to the party, but you get there sooner or later. So
what was it like for you to see, I mean, you're seeing these artists in coffee houses to a certain degree, and then you watch them rocket to a level of fame that is reserved only for football players these days, just a monumental amount of fame. What kind of effect do you think that had on you?
I just consider myself so, so fortunate. I remember seeing the Blues Project in the Village again on that trip. They were unknown. I mean, so many of the guys in that band went on to have incredible careers and play with, you know, the biggest artists of their generation. And I think there were like five or six people in the club. And it was like, what an incredible experience to, you know, be there early on. And that's something, I mean, what Greenwich Village had to offer in those early 60s became, you know, what we call counterculture worldwide. So it was I'm just so fortunate. I mean, so much, you know, people say you're lucky that you had the career you had. And I think, you know, I worked really hard at what I did, but I got lucky about when I was born, because as you alluded to, Joe, it was just an incredible time. There was so much energy and music was so exciting, and you know, so many new frontiers being explored, and you know, things going in ways that no one could have anticipated before that. I mean, I just blew the doors open, and I was very, very fortunate to be, you know, a young kid at that time and get to see it and be influenced by it.
Did it seem attainable to you at that time? Like, did you have a moment when you knew that this was a path that you were going to try, or did it seem completely unattainable to you?
That's a really good question. I because of my being inspired by these people we were talking about, you know, I got a Pete Seeger songbook and a banjo for my birthday, I think it was, not too long afterwards. And I remember just learning the first four chords, like there was a chord, you know, chord charts and then songs you could play. So I learned the first three or four chords in the, on the chord, you know, chart section. And, that was it. I just started writing songs. So it wasn't particularly premeditated or careerist, you know what I mean? I wasn't trying to be a rock star. And as far as not being a rock star, I've succeeded very well at that. I just was just, you know, driven. I was compelled. I loved doing it so much. And music meant so much to me and still does. You know, there was no kind of careerist mentality there. It was just, I have to do this. It makes my life, you know, keeps me sane, or at least as sane as possible. I wouldn't say sane, that may be going too far, but yeah, it just meant so much to me and helped me so much in my life that I just kept on that path.
It's interesting to me that the way that you just described it, composition was almost instantly a part of what you were pursuing. So many people learn an instrument and they'll spend years, maybe a decade. I've talked to people on the show who spent two decades playing an instrument and never wrote a song, whereas you got about three chords in and composition was instantly the focus. What do you think it was about either your upbringing or your character or your interest? Why do you think you went directly to composition in a way that was much faster than most people would have?
You know, that's something I've never thought about. I think it was the influence. Okay, so that moment in time, you had Dylan, by then you had the Beatles, you know, maybe a year or so later, by the time I was in my, you know, 13, the Beatles were breaking. And you knew that these artists wrote their own songs. So that just seemed to be baked into the exercise for me. I just understood that it was a vehicle for you expressing your own feelings and you know, what was on your mind. And it was also the great age of protest songs. Mm-hmm. The war in Vietnam was ramping up. People not a lot older than I than I was at the time were being shipped off to Vietnam. So it just became instantly a vehicle for self-expression, and that meant being a songwriter. Now, having said that, there were people who expressed themselves through their instrument, mm-hmm. and were really good at it. I don't know that I was ever, and to this day, and I don't consider myself a great musician. I mean, I can obviously play chords. I play just well enough to write songs. Let's put it yes. that way. And I never had an ambition to be better than that as a player. It was always, the instrument was always a vehicle to write songs. So
it does seem yeah. like that is a very common divide. They're almost two different things. And I've seen people who are excellent at their instruments that you would hire for a session in a heartbeat. But then you might listen to their songs and the songs, what do they lack? They lack, I feel like you starting in that way, and you said you play the instrument just good enough to write the song. I think writers who write like that are using their ear a lot more, and they're writing as a listener of the song a lot more than maybe people who are musician first.
Yeah, I think that's very perceptive. And I do, I've had the benefit of working with some incredible musicians, and they write. But you know, the thing is, and you know, this is my particular take on songwriting, and maybe it shows a prejudice, but it's a lyrical medium. I don't think people understand. I think that's where musicians and songwriters depart. Yeah. That's where the parting of the ways is that for me, the music is there to support the lyrics. For musicians, the music is a thing of itself.
Yes.
And I appreciate that. I totally appreciate that. I get that. And that's a wonderful path to go down as well. But for me, it was always, the words were always, and again, people like Dylan, a fellow Canadian, Leonard Cohen. I mean, there were guys out there that was so obvious that the lyrics were really, in a way, what was all about, and the music was kind of the delivery system.
Yes,
for what they had to say to the world.
Even a child can realize it. When I'm putting my young kids to bed at night, I'll say, "Okay, three songs," and then you go to bed. And if the last song, maybe I'll play, you know, some little bit of classical music or something, you know, and they'll say to me, "That didn't count. We only had two songs because that one didn't have words." You know, like they don't even recognize it as a song if there's not a lyrical component.
Wow. You have very smart children.
I don't know about that. Talk children. To their teachers about that, Mr. Schwartz. So there's kind of, I look at your biography and how your career went. Your first solo record on Infinity wouldn't come out till about 1980. So you're 31 at that point, but you have just been describing this journey that you went on, began at, you know, 12 years old when you went down to Greenwich Village. What did you spend your 20s doing, and what were you learning at that time that would prepare you for the beginning of your solo career?
Yeah, another great question. Well, I was in bands. I was on the road. By the time I was 15, I was playing in bands, doing gigs, playing high schools, playing church basements, playing, you know, community centers. And that went through till I was almost, I was actually 30 in 80, cause I was born the last week of 49. So, I was 1 year younger, but, I was on the road and, learning my craft. Now, the other thing that I should mention is that I was acoustic guitar player up until I was probably in my mid 20s. And then I got a gig with a well-known Canadian artist by the name of Charity Brown, and they were looking for an electric guitar player. So that was also a huge change in my life, because that instrument took me to a whole different place. I mean, I never would have written some of the songs that I wrote if I hadn't, someone had said, "Hey, she was paying me on a weekly basis to play electric guitar, not acoustic." And that was also life changing. But yeah, I was just on the road. I played all over Canada, played bars when I was underage, come back to that. By then I was, 17, 18, was 20, you had to be 21 to drink in a bar in Canada back in those days. Saw the country and in the van with the rest of the band and all the equipment and the roadies and yep. sleeping on people's floors and, It was so that was that took me up until really a song called "Hit Me with Your Best Shot."
Wow,
seemed to
so that
explode.
That was the weeding out process for anyone who wasn't serious about it. You spend, you know, a decade sleeping on people's floors and riding in the 15 passenger van. That'll weed out a lot of people who don't really want to do it.
Oh yeah, yeah. Oh no, it was again, you know, it was just, you had it was a compulsion. It just, I just had to do it. It wasn't, there wasn't much of a decision. It wasn't much of a, you know, a thought process or a career path. It's just, this is what I'm doing.
What were you learning about composition at that point, either through teaching yourself kind of in as an autodidact or maybe picking up from some of the people that you were working with and for?
Yeah, the great teachers I had were the other guys in the band, because very often there were better guitar players. I was fortunate enough to work with in bands where I was the sort of the rhythm guitar mm-hmm. player. So, and, you know, I was up to that role. I could certainly, you know, work my way through the changes. But there were much better guitar players playing lead guitar in many of the bands I was in over those years. And I just went to school on them. So as far as, you know, learning voicings and, you know, how to play lead guitar, how to explore the instrument in a way that I hadn't, it was really my bandmates. It wasn't just the guitar players too. I mean, we had a Jamaican bass player in Charity Brown's band, and I would be writing songs, working on songs, the dressing room before we went on the stage in some club somewhere, Sturgeon Falls, Ontario, you know, somewhere way, way up north. Yeah. And our Jamaican bass player, he'd say, "Hey, man, I like that. That, what are you doing there?" You know, and he would, sorry for my not very bad Jamaican accent, but, and he would come over and we would, you know, talk, and he would say, "What are you doing?" And, you know, and we would talk about the changes and what I was doing. So yeah, those guys were my teachers.
You mentioned them just teaching you different voicings, which sounds like a small thing, but voicings are kind of everything, because it really does lead your melody to a place. If you voice it differently, you're just going to hear a melody that you wouldn't have otherwise. So to have those in your tool bag can be so important.
I couldn't agree with you more. And finding your way through that. I mean, when you start playing around with voicing these the different voicings up and down the neck for a chord, you know, and then you can sort of start figuring out your own little changes to those things.
Yes.
Or the way you can hammer on or slide to, or, and those things all have some influence, I think, on how you write. So yeah, I mean, and it's still learning. I know there's a gentleman now, I don't remember his name, who analyzes the chords to Beatles songs on Instagram.
Yeah, I follow him. Yep.
And yeah, and I'm just dying. Somebody just turned me on to it. And I saw the first one, and it was like, there's that many chords and, you know, some of these early Beatles songs. I mean, some of them are just three chords, twist and shout, you know, three chord special, as we call them. But then some of them, If I Fell, I think it was. God, it's like the chord change on every quarter note.
It is.
I mean, it's just insane how the knowledge, you know, you don't appreciate the knowledge those guys had.
It's
In terms of voicings and chord progression.
They have like six of those novel chord changes in some of those tunes. And if I'm watching one of those videos and take simply one of those chords that I don't normally use, it will open up an entire new song for me. Because you hear that one little lyrical shift that's interesting to you that you've never done before. And they would have six of them in one song. It's unreal.
I couldn't agree with you more. Those things just open up doors to your imagination. And you know, I get asked, you know, what's your advice to a young somebody who wants to get into music now? Is saying, learn an instrument. Mm-hmm. Learn an instrument, because, you know, it's one thing to put a prompt into Suno.
Yeah.
It's another thing to learn an instrument and follow that. You'll find there's a lot more satisfaction in finding
100%
that path. Not that I'm getting into a whole AI thing now, but...
Well, anyway, we can get there later, because I want to talk about that, especially in relation with all your advocacy for music rights. But yeah, I mean, they should learn instruments. It's funny, I talk to people who are 10 or 15 years younger than me. I'm 41, and I'll ask them, I'm like, okay, you're getting started. Are you playing open mics? They'll say, yeah, I'm playing open mics. I'm like, how's that scene now? They go, well, 75% of people just get up there with an iPad and a backing track and they sing to it. And it's like, man, I don't want to sound like the old man here, but they're really missing out on that point by not learning the instrument, because you're never going to be able to compose in a certain way unless you're discovering those chords, those voicings, stuff like that.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. So, you know, without getting into, as you said, the advocacy side of things or the legality and all that stuff. You know, again, going back to those years before I knew that I, you know, started to make a living doing songwriting, it kept me alive emotionally. I mean, there's, you know, teenage years are, for many of us, and certainly for me, very challenging emotionally. Teenage and 20s, those years, music kept me alive. Music kept me alive. The fact I had that outlet for my confusion and emotions and anxiety and, you know, all the things that are going on inside young people. Even if I had never made a nickel, you know, doing it, I would have no regrets, because it just kept me emotionally and I think intellectually and in many different ways about as sane as I could have been. And without it, I hesitate to, I wonder if I'd even be here.
Wow. You did your time in other folks' bands during that time in your 20s. And then in 1980, your first record comes out. You put out several as a solo artist in a quick succession, eventually with A&M. What did it feel like to step out, to take the three steps up, you know, to the center mic and have it be your own gig? Was that an exciting thing? Was that a frightening thing? Was it both?
Yeah, it was both. It was both. Those days, I mean, getting a record deal meant that, it's kind of like the pearly gates opened up. At least that's what it felt like from the outside. Once you passed through the pearly gates, there was a whole other set of problems one had to deal with. Yeah. But you know, when you got a record deal, it was big news. And eventually I got a record deal with Atlantic Records in New York. And that was, you know, that was Nirvana. But then, you know, there's other things that kick in that are sobering. And I don't know how far down that road we want to get, but it was to be an artist is, I think, much harder than being a songwriter. First of all, I was still a songwriter, so I still had all that responsibility, if you want to call it that. But and now you're working with A&R people, and you are submitting songs to them, and they're going, well, yeah, I don't hear the first single yet. Yeah, not good enough. How come there's no bridge in that one? You know, you're getting all this feedback. And I was getting feedback to some extent from publishers before that. But now it's kind of more personal, because now it's about you as an artist. Mm-hmm. And they're holding you up. You can't move forward with making a record until the A&R people are satisfied. The A&R guy or gals in a record label are satisfied. So now you're kind of working for them. And that was a challenge. But, you know, on the flip side of that, I don't want to make it sound totally negative, is that it kicks your butt to write the best songs you can. You know, you got to get past these people. So the upside is that I think it's in a way good to be challenged, and to, you know, and the songs that end up being recorded, I think in many ways were better because of it. So yeah, it's daunting. It's daunting. And at the same time, other people were starting to record my songs, Joe. So, and that path became easier for me. So now I was in kind of a strange conflict that a lot of, people, you know, artists who also write, find themselves in, which is, you want all these songs for yourself. But I had a music publisher at the time, was ATV, who became Sony ATV. They wanted to get, you know, if a Pat Benatar or, you know, a Peter Frampton or one of those folks who already were, they knew were going to sell a lot of records, they're interested in recording one of your songs that are on your own record, you get into a conflict there. And so that was another, part of the package.
Obviously, the first one of those that really hit, that it sounds like ATV had been working to get placed, was Pat Benatar's Hit Me With Your Best Shot. And so what you're describing there, it almost sounds like that's bittersweet, sweet in the sense of damn, I got a hit, and there's probably some mailbox money coming in and all that, and maybe a little bit bitter because you think to yourself, like, man, what if that had been my single? What if I was, you know, known for that song in the way that she is now?
Yeah, and it was on that song was on my that A&M record, that first 1980s album that you mentioned. So yeah, it came off, and I put another song. I had to write another song and get it on the record at the last minute. There's no way on earth I can complain about what happened.
Right.
From that point forward, and you know they. You know, Pat and Neil and the team who put that record together did an amazing job.
Yeah.
And so did Chrysalis Records at that time. So I can't complain. It opened up a lot of doors for me. But yeah, I do wonder from time to time what would have happened if things had gone a different way and I'd put the song out and put that first album out with that as the first single. For me, it would have been a very different situation.
Different is the word, because I think, you know, all of us have a bias in our mind to think if things were different, the bias is towards like it would have been great. But it's different. The deal is it could have not gone great too. Who knows, you know, what an insane amount of stardom would have done to you in your early 30s. I mean, it could have been great, but we've all seen it not work out for people too in pretty serious ways.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is, by the time it came out and was, you know, it was the second single off her sophomore record, I guess, Crimes of Passion. And by the time it came out, you know, as a songwriter, what's sort of also maybe worth mentioning is so that's a song that I wrote or finished. It took me a couple of years to write it, but I finished it in 1978. So now the first time I actually hear it on the radio in Toronto is early 1981. So I'm almost 3 years down the road with songs.
Yeah.
So that's also a very weird thing for a songwriter. It's like, that's sort of a piece of my past at that
right.
point. And now it's like playing on, you know, radios. The first time I heard it, I was, you know, walking up Yonge Street. I mentioned Yonge Street again. Seems to be a bit of a theme, but walking up Yonge Street and heard it coming out of, you know, it was a warm spring day and people had the doors open. I heard it coming out of a hairstylist place on Yonge Street. And I went, God, that sounds familiar.
Yes.
And as I got closer, I realized what it was and kind of flipped out. But that's a very strange thing how you're disconnected in time very often.
Yeah.
You know, I have songs that got cut 8 or 10 years after I wrote
right.
them.
Right. And you've moved on as an artist and a songwriter at that point. And another trick I think we have to play on ourselves sometimes is you always want to feel like I'm actually doing my best work right now. So to have something like that come in that you feel like a different artist, you feel like it's part of your past, it had to be a little bit of a mind trip to have that receive such success while you're working in a new field at that point.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't know that I've ever really totally processed it. It's a song that, you know, I've heard, you know, in a cab in Paris. It's a song I've heard at the foot of Mount Fuji in Japan. It's, you know, people have called me from, you know, some small town in Italy, friends of mine saying, yeah, listen to what I'm hearing right now, you know. And, it's sort of a bit hard to get your head around, at least it is for me. I'm not complaining.
Yeah.
But it's a lot to handle on some level.
When you wrote that one, did you feel like it was special in a way? We just had a songwriter on here named Ray Fulcher who wrote that huge Luke Combs hit, When It Rains, It Pours. And when he came on the show, he was saying a bunch of record execs listened to the whole record, and Luke Combs came back to him and was like, there's a song that they really love, When It Rains, It Pours. And his perspective was like, I like that song, but that one, that was the one that they picked out. So were you kind of surprised in the way he was there, or did you always feel like there was something special about that tune?
Yeah, I have a very opposite, you know, ATV hated it. They thought it was the worst song I ever wrote. And I did think there was something about it. I thought it was very well put together, but particularly for the reason that I thought I captured a certain attitude, a certain, you know, defiance, self-empowerment, you know, whatever word you want to use, underdog, you know, David and Goliath, you know, I mean, you know what I'm getting at here. And I thought I'd really, I thought I'd really captured that particular message.
Yes.
And I thought both the music and lyrically, it worked really well together. And I thought the guitar, just for, you know, a little icing on the top, the guitar riff was pretty catchy. So I did feel something about that song. I thought it was good, but they didn't want to demo at ATV. They hated it. I think to allude to a question you asked earlier, there was one guy in New York who liked it. His name was Marv Goodman, and everybody else in the company hated it. And fortunately, he was working at Chrysalis. He was about to go over to ATV. And I had one copy of the song because they actually erased the original demo of it. But I had one copy on a cassette, and I sent it down from Toronto to New York. And he was listening to it, and that's how Pat Benatar heard it, because he was, as I said, still at Chrysalis, which was her record label. So it was all kind of a bizarre trip. Like, my publisher hates it. This thing's never going to see the light of day. Next thing I know, you know, this one guy likes it, and then it just, you know, explodes from there. So it was quite a different genesis.
Eddie Schwartz has managed to balance creativity and commerce throughout his career better than almost any other artist that we've ever had on this program. He's not only penned platinum songs, but also presided at the head of songwriter advocacy groups that protect the rights of platinum songwriters. And there's a poem about responsibility that reminds me of this by Donald Justice entitled Men at 40. Men at 40 learn to close softly the doors to rooms they will not be coming back to. At rest on a stair landing, they feel it moving beneath them now, like the deck of a ship, though the swell is gentle. And deep in mirrors, they rediscover the face of the boy as he practices tying his father's tie there in secret. And the face of that father, still warm with the mystery of lather. They are more fathers than sons themselves now. Something is filling them, something that is like the twilight sound of the crickets, immense, filling the woods at the foot of the slope behind their mortgaged houses.
I want to circle back for just a moment to something that you said earlier that I thought was interesting and I wanted to know more about. You said when you were primarily working as an artist and you start working, you get through those pearly gates of the record labels, you first said. They really kicked your butt on improving these songs. I guess my question is, was that improvement made through sheer volume of songs that you were writing? You're just writing more to get across the finish line? Or was it made by specific changes that they were asking for and specific improvements in your own craft that you had to learn?
Well, I got to think about that one for a second. I think it was kind of both, probably. It was probably all of the above. It's really hard when you finish a song to come back to it right away, especially if you think it's right. So very often I would probably try something else, go to another idea. And because now I probably had some, you know, now I would have had a sense of what they're looking for. And so I might start again, you know, like I remember famously getting Well, there's no bridge. Song's no good because there's no bridge. Well, Hit Me With Your Best Shot has no bridge. There are many, many songs that do very, very well that don't have a bridge. Don't get me wrong. I love a good bridge, but it's not mandatory. And I remember one of the A&R guys, that was his comment on a couple of the songs I thought were really good. And so, you know, all right, whatever I write is going to have a bridge. And I don't remember ever putting a bridge in the song that he commented on, but I just made sure that the next one I worked on had a bridge. And, you know, I wouldn't have put a bridge in if I didn't think it was appropriate.
Right.
So I would come up with I would look at my idea and say, well, this one, you know, this one makes sense in the context of what this guy apparently likes. So, you know, and once they gave you the okay and you're in the studio, you always knew that you had a little bit of latitude.
Yeah.
Because once you're finally in the studio and recording, yeah, you're going to, what are they going to do? Throw you out if you're halfway through an
right.
album?
Yeah.
I mean, they could theoretically, but, so it was a bit of a game. You had to get past these guys and then get into, and remember studios in those days, every hour could be $300, $400. I mean, it was an expensive, I mean, what I'm saying is I don't necessarily blame them. They were about to put a lot of money out,
right?
Put, you know, they were betting a good chunk of money on you. So they wanted to make sure they had something that they believed in. And I get that.
Once the 80s start rolling there, you just head off on this torrent of different albums that you were writing for, some that you were producing with, you know, major, major artists, the Doobie Brothers, the Pointer Sisters, Paul Carrack, Donna Summer. What do you remember about that season of your life? Because from the outside looking in, it looks like you never left a studio floor for about a decade.
Mm. Yeah, it was a wonderful and productive time. I spent a lot of those years writing with a guy named David Tyson, who also wrote a song called Black Velvet, and worked with Hall & Oates later on in his career, and brilliant keyboard player and great arranger. You know, so we were kind of inseparable for about 5 years. And then he went on to produce and co-write with Alana Miles and other artists. So that was a great creative period. We wrote a song called All Our Tomorrows, Special Girl, songs that have, you know, had a life, you know, for me as an artist, actually, in the years since. I worked with a guy named Larry Gowan a lot. That was sort of a little later in the 90s. But it was a very productive time. And remarkably, I think for every two songs I wrote, one of them got cut.
Wow.
So I was at a 50%. I mean, it's a pretty good feeling, I have to admit. And, you know, again, I didn't live or die by Billboard by any means. In fact, I never subscribed to Billboard, but it was nice when, you know, one of my publishers would hand me a copy of it, and I would see that I had three things on various charts in Billboard at the same time, with some of those artists. That was, but you know, the thing is, the thing about the success in the business is you can't take it too seriously, because you never know what tomorrow's going to bring.
Yeah, no, it's and over five decades, you've seen it change overnight many, many times. One of the things I think about the most is these hair metal bands that were huge in the 80s. They were living on top of the world, and then Nirvana Nevermind comes out, and it's not that they're out of a job at that point. Obviously, they're still huge artists, but the whole culture changed overnight once grunge music hit, and it must have really thrown them for a loop when that happened, and that happens all the time.
It does. It does. And it was, with all due respect to the hair bands, it was time for them to make their...
Fair enough.
The Nirvana was fantastic.
Oh,
so.
Yeah. It still holds up today.
Yeah.
Talk to me about, seems like, so you were also very much known, especially within the business, for your advocacy for songwriters. And that's a project, it seems like, you know, not only for yourself, but because you're a songwriter, but also the people coming behind you. I always really, it seemed like Tom Petty did something relatively similar, and I always respected him for that. When did advocacy for songwriters come onto your radar, and how did you begin doing that?
Yeah, thanks, Joe. The so this is a struggle that's been going on almost from the beginning of my career. Certainly by the mid 80s, I was aware of it. I was too busy with music at that time to devote a lot of time to it. But I was approached by some publishers, actually, in Canada, music publishers. And at that time in Canada, and I think might have been true in the States as well, songwriters and publishers were sharing, usually split 50-50, 2 cents per side was what the law was. So if you sold a record, you got 2 cents per each side. So for an album of 5 songs on one side, 5 songs on the other, so 10 songs, could be 12 songs in some cases, you still got 2 cents. So if you wrote every song on an album, you'd get a penny per side. And even in the mid 80s, that was not enough money to make, you know, to live on. So I was asked to become part of a group, and it was some of the other folks involved were Brian Adams, Randy Bachman of the Guess Who and Bachman Turner Overdrive, and a whole list of successful Canadian music creators, artists, songwriters, who went to Ottawa in Canada, which is the capital, and lobbied for an increase in mechanical rates, because it was the law in Canada. We couldn't get, right, unless the law was changed. And the same thing in the States, yep, by the way. Same campaign was going on south of the border as well as in Canada. So, and we were successful. We got it up to, I think, 8 or 9 cents. And now I think it's up to 13 cents. Still not a lot of money, but it made a difference. It made a difference to songwriters and composers' lives and to music publishers as well. So I think that's where it got started for me. I saw that this was kind of a constant struggle just to make a living, even in the, you know, the halcyon days of the music business, yeah, which we look back now and go, oh my God, we didn't realize it was a golden era at, right, the time. But you look back at it now and I think, you know, it's kind of the way I feel about it. But it's always been a struggle. And the fact of the matter is, sadly, it's gotten not better, but worse over the years. And streaming is fantastic. It's a great technology. And it certainly makes accessing all kinds of music so easy for everybody. But it pays so, so little that the next generation of songwriters and artists are just, it's just about impossible to make.
Especially if you're just a writer. I've been going to spend some time with guys in Nashville, guys and gals in Nashville who are just writers and not artists, and talking to them, they'll be like, yeah, man, you know, if I had this song that I had on this person's record in 1999, I'd own a 5,000 square foot house, and now I'm, you know, not exactly paycheck to paycheck, but it's a lot less. And so you're seeing a lot of these writers actually go to artists, and if they're established already, they're asking for part of the master when they go to write with somebody.
Yeah, I that's an interesting approach, and you've got to do something. But you know, the labels, the right now, the master on, you know, streaming services gets about, I think, something like 10 times what the song gets.
Right.
And I think that's a big part of the problem. I mean, I don't know if it's going to get us all the way there. I'd like to see everybody make more money, right, in streaming services. It might mean that people have to pay 15 or 20 bucks a month instead of, you know, 9. And let's keep in mind, Spotify still has a free service, which millions of people, yep, use. It's just very exploitive. So I would say there's the streaming services shouldn't have free tiers, because people need to make a living doing this, especially if millions of people are listening to your music and enjoying it. So no free tiers, more money out of the streaming services, and more equity between what the master attracts money-wise and what the song. Because, you know, you think about yesterday, you know, let's go back to the Beatles for a minute. Like, what's worth more money, the performance of that or that amazing song? Right. And I think it's fair to say they're both worth the same. They both contributed equally to the success of that, and we can. There's a million other records we could pick. I'm just picking that one because arguably maybe one of the most successful, if not the most successful song of all time. But yeah, equity between the value of the recording and the song, I think, would go a long way.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, just jacking up the price of the service a little bit, I can remember in the 90s going to buy probably a Nirvana record new at the store, and it was $20. And not only was it $20, it was 1997 bucks, which in 2025 would be the equivalent of about $40, and that was for one record. So the idea that, that you'd have to pay $20 a month to listen to the entirety of, you know, musical recorded output, it just doesn't hold water for me that you can't charge more for that. I think people obviously would. Now, especially now that they interact with the product on a daily basis, and they say it's a good product, it's a very good product, it's fantastic, it just needs to cost more.
And the free tier is that yeah, I think that's indefensible.
Personally, I'd have to agree. I'll pick your brain just briefly on this. You're probably tired of people talking about it, but what are your views now on AI and all these music generation platforms that are coming out? How do you think songwriters can make this work for us?
Well, that's another technology that doesn't pay. I mean, what they're paying right now is zero.
Right.
And yet, it's no secret that they actually train. The generative AI has been trained on the music of all of us who, you know, got stuff out there in the world. They scrape the world's music, not just that, books and movies and all kinds of other things that all deserve some kind of credit and some kind of payment. And these companies are worth billions and billions and billions of dollars. So, yeah, I think they need to pay for the training phase. They're fighting that tooth and nail in court. We'll see where that goes. And, you know, it could take years before it's resolved, which obviously also works to their benefit.
Right.
Again, the labels, some of the big labels are making deals, and that I think there might be some hope there, but I'm also a little troubled who's going to be the main beneficiaries of those deals, how much of that's going to filter through to the actual, you know, creators, music creators themselves. That's something, and we've asked that question. We'd like to get more information, but so far it's all very opaque. We have no idea really what the deals are or how that's going to work. So that's a little concerning. So as far as Gen AI as a tool itself, though, I want to be very clear. I'm not against technology. In fact, I love technology. I believe in technology. I know it's not going away. So this is not about, you know, us reverting to the glory days of yesteryear. That's never going to happen. But so I do see it as a useful tool. Again, though, if the song is written by a human being, or human beings. Because I think I've spent a little time on Suno. I think where Suno and some of these other platforms do have a contribution to make is in demoing songs. So once you have a song that, you know, has a meaningful lyric, because the lyrics from these Gen AI generated songs are just
hot garbage,
meaningless, and slop, to use that word, that term that a lot of people are using. But if you learn how to write a song, learn how to, you know, it's not, songs are not just intelligence, artificial or otherwise. They're heart and soul and, you know, love and pain and this, you know, the span of human emotions. That's what makes music so powerful and so wonderful, and joy, and, you know, not just all negative stuff either. So I think once you have a song that successfully captures and communicates real human emotion, and I think Gen AI has a role to play.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's that human emotion. It's also what we're learning from the slop that comes off the AI that is really special to human songwriters is cultural understanding, like a deep cultural understanding of knowing how to communicate in a parlance that an audience is going to resonate with, which I just, you know, they say that it's going to, they say that the curve with AI is going to be like a hockey stick and go straight up, but we'll see. I'm skeptical. Well, if you could just leave me with this, I would love to know, after all these years working and still creating, if you wake up on a day like today and you don't have to do a podcast interview with a guy like me and you're going to spend some time writing, what does your day and your process look like when you're working on something creative?
Yeah, I mean, again, the compulsion continues unabated. I'm still a compulsive songwriter, and always, I mean, to me, it's like the world is full of opportunities for ideas that end up being songs. So part of it is picking up an instrument and hopefully being inspired by the music to write a melody, like a chord change or a feel, to come up with a melody and then fill in the blanks in terms of, well, what do I want to say? I mean, to me, words, as I've said earlier, I never want them just to be filler for the notes. I want the words themselves to also stand on their own two feet. So, but you know, I mean, I'll be walking or driving or listening to somebody else's music or watching TV and just jotting down ideas for lyrics, for a line here and a line there. And so it's just kind of woven into my every breathing, every waking moment. And I do have a pad next to the bed because, you know, I've made the mistake of thinking of something when I was half asleep and saying, well, I'll never forget that. That's such
classic.
A great idea. When I wake up in the morning, yeah. And of course I wake up in the morning and go, why didn't I just write that down?
I know. That's, you know, the voice memos are great for that too, because not only that, sometimes it's like the phrasing, like the specific phrasing of something that attaches to a lyric that if you're going to bed and you think, I'll remember, I'll write down the thing. And I'll be like, I'll remember how that's phrased. And then I wake up in the morning and I'm like, man, I don't know what it was. I just know it wasn't that, you know, and it kills you to not have it voice memoed out.
You're totally right. Sometimes it's just like you look at it and you go, if it's on the written page, you look at it and say, there was something more to this than that.
Yes.
And it was the phrasing or the note or the, you know, the melody you may have, you know, had in your mind. So I couldn't agree with you more.
Well, listen, it's been such an honor to have you on the show. Thank you so much for appearing on The Working Songwriter.
Joe, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
This week's show is brought to you by Bandzoogle. Built by musicians and for musicians, Bandzoogle is an all-in-one platform to build a beautiful website for your music. Use promo code TWS, the initials of our podcast, TWS, to get 15% off the first year of any new subscription. Eddie Schwartz's latest EP is entitled Film School, available everywhere music is sold or streamed. If before we meet again, you sit down to write, please remember, an expensive drug habit is not a song, a compelling Instagram account is not a song, and most importantly, reverb is not a song. So let all that take care of itself, and for you, just keep your eye on the song.